Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the siege at an upscale mall in Nairobi, Kenya, and speak with Makua Matawa, who is the Dean of the Buffalo Law School and a columnist for The Standard on Sunday, one of the two main newspapers in Kenya and East Africa. We will discuss the endemic political corruption in Kenya and how much it has hampered efforts to subdue the Somali al-Shabaab terrorists whose murderous rampage in retaliation to 4,000 Kenyan troops in Somalia is meant to drive a wedge between Kenya's Christian majority and its Muslim minority. Then we will speak with Ambassador Theodore Katouf, a former U.S. ambassador to Syria, who knows the ruling Assad family and has met with Syrian dictator's reclusive and violence-prone younger brother, Maher Assad, who heads up the regime's Praetorian Guard and its murderous militias. We'll discuss Iran's behind-the-scenes role in bringing about the Russian-American deal to control and destroy Syria's chemical weapons arsenal and the possibility of U.S.-Iranian cooperation in ending Syria's bloody civil war. Then finally, we will speak with Sister Simone Campbell, the Executive Director of Network, a Catholic social justice network, who the previous Pope singled out for criticism for her support of President Obama's healthcare reform push and her failure to promote church teachings on abortion, contraception, and homosexuality. We will discuss the new Pope Francis's radical reversal, de-emphasizing these issues while calling on the church to be less judgmental and more pastoral, as well as the fate of the Affordable Care Act after the House's 42nd vote to kill it in the latest showdown over shutting down the government to defund Obamacare. And joining us now is Makua Matawa, who is the Dean of the University of Buffalo Law School and a State University of New York Distinguished Professor. He writes a column for The Standard on Sunday, one of the two main newspapers in Kenya and East Africa, and his books include Kenya's Quest for Democracy, Taming Leviathan, Human Rights NGOs in East Africa, Political and Normative Tensions, and Human Rights, a Political and Cultural Critique. In 2003, he was appointed by Kenya's President Kibaki to chair a task force that eventually led to the establishment of the Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission in 2008. Welcome to Background Briefing, Makua Matawa.
Thank you so much, sir. Thank you for having me.
And obviously, this is a very sad day for Kenya and for Kenyans. And so far, about 60 people have died and 175 have been injured in this, what is the deadliest attack in Kenya since the 1998 U.S. Embassy bombings. The situation has been going on since noon Saturday. It still continues as we speak. What's your explanation for why this thing has gone on for so long, Makua?
Well, I think, first of all, it's a tragic event in Kenya's history, coming clearly at just a horrible moment for the country, because as you probably know, the president and the deputy president are indicted for war crimes at the International Criminal Court at The Hague. And one of the trials has, in fact, started for that of the deputy president. So the attack comes at a time of great angst and turmoil in Kenya. And as far as the attack is concerned, this particular mall is a complex that was recently constructed. It's an upscale shopping center, you know, for Kenyan elites and expatriates. And it's itself quite a complex building, you know, and so there are many places for attackers to hide. But I also suspect that the attack surprised the guards at the mall, you know, who are, appears people have been very slow to respond to the attack. And so the attackers, you know, appear to have gained, you know, a foothold in some of the rooms and buildings within the mall. And in addition to that, I mean, it appears that the attack was well planned. Indications are that, you know, the attackers knew the building, the layout of the building, and therefore were able to really conceal themselves and obviously prolong this attack.
Well, there's no question that the attackers are Islamist radicals from al-Shabaab, the militia group in Somalia to the north. One of the first things that they did when they took over the mall was to shout at the people, stand up if you're Muslim, and we're here to save you. And that one of them asked an Indian gentleman the name of the prophet's mother, and he was unable to answer, and he was shot dead. So the sectarian nature of this is pretty obvious, is it not?
Well, there's no question but that, you know, Al-Shabaab is an extremist Islamic militia, which arose in the ashes, really, of the collapse of the Somali state in the last decade or so, after a prolonged period of state failure in Somalia. The ideology is really no different from that of Al-Qaeda. In fact, Al-Shabaab is an affiliate, an official affiliate of Al-Qaeda itself. And so the sectarian nature of the attack is without question. You'll recall that several years ago, Kenya went into Somalia to join the African forces fighting to oust Al-Shabaab from controlling the country. And that fight, which, you know, took about a year, was actually quite successful. And Al-Shabaab was driven from many of its strongholds. And of course, it then retreated into guerrilla, you know, attacks across the country in Somalia. In fact, a simultaneous attack took place in Mogadishu, the capital of Somalia, at the same time that, you know, they were attacking Nairobi, which appears to have been a kind of a simulation of the 1998 Al-Qaeda bombings in Nairobi, Kenya's capital, and Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, which took place at the same time. So, yes, I mean, there's no question that Al-Shabaab is behind the attack. They posted on their Twitter account, you know, a claim of responsibility for the attack, you know, and it is without question, I think, quite a barbaric act.
Again, I'm speaking with Makau Matua, who is the Dean of the University of Buffalo Law School and a State University of New York Distinguished Professor. He writes a column for The Standard on Sunday, one of the two main newspapers in Kenya and East Africa, and his books include Kenya's Quest for Democracy, Taming Leviathan, Human Rights NGOs in East Africa, Political and Normative Tensions, and Human Rights, a Political and Cultural Critique. In 2003, he was appointed by Kenya's President Kibaki to chair a task force that eventually led to the establishment of the Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission in 2008. And you mentioned the head of state, Uhuru Kenyatta, who is along with his deputy prime minister, William Ruto, who was actually in The Hague before the International Criminal Court. He apparently, as far as we know, he's been granted permission to go back to deal with the crisis in Nairobi. Already we've learned that the nephew, Magangwi, and his fiancée, Rosemary Wahito, they are nephews of President Uhuru Kenyatta, who have been killed in this mall attack, along with a Canadian diplomat, a very popular radio host, and a number of other foreign nationals, along with up to 60 people and 175 injured. And, of course, it continues with hostages taken as well. So tell me, you mentioned that the guards weren't up to the task. What do we understand about what's happening now in terms of hostage rescue teams, whatever? Is there negotiations going on? It's all, the news is pretty sketchy.
Yeah, it's pretty sketchy, you know, because I think that you know, the Al-Shabaab attackers are holed up in several places in the building holding hostages. And it's not clear how many hostages are being held. Some reports indicate that, you know, many people are missing, as many as, you know, 60 or 50 or thereabouts. You know, so it's unclear whether, you know, there are negotiations which are going on. Reports of gunfire, you know, continue to be received. But let me just, you know, say that with respect to the, you know, the tragic deaths of the people in the building, including the relatives of the president and the Canadian diplomat. Let me just say that this mall is frequented by, you know, people of means, and so therefore it is not really a surprise that those people were in the building at the time when it was attacked. You know, with respect to the deputy president that you mentioned, who is now on trial at The Hague, my understanding is that, you know, the court is going to hear his request to be excused from the trial so that he can go back to Kenya to attend to this particular issue. It's not clear to me whether the court will grant that request for him to be given a few days off to go back to Kenya before the trial resumes. If I had to guess, I would probably say it's probably unlikely that the court would grant the request, since the president of the country is in Nairobi taking care of business.
But this is not a happy situation. Apparently, a lot of people in Kenya are very uncomfortable with it. It's obviously a huge black eye to the country. And on top of that, now you have this ongoing terrorist siege in a very upscale mall in retaliation by Al-Shabaab, in retaliation for the presence of 4,000 Kenyan troops in Somalia.
Absolutely, absolutely. But let me just remind our listeners that both Mr. Kenyatta and Mr. Ruto ran for office as president, as a presidential candidate and deputy presidential candidate, fully aware that they were indicted for crimes against humanity. They knew that they were indicted. In fact, you know, Kenyan civil society filed cases in Kenyan courts to stop, you know, them from running for office, arguing that, you know, the indictment itself prohibited them from running for public office. The court cleared them to run for office, which, you know, appears to have been a mistake in itself. And on several occasions during the campaigns, you know, Mr. Kenyatta and Mr. Ruto were challenged by Kenyans to explain how they would be able to run the country while if they won the election, how they would be able to run the country while they were on trial at The Hague. And both of them assured the country that that there was no problem, that the charges for crimes against humanity were a personal challenge, as they put it, and I'm quoting that, personal challenge. And of course, as we are seeing now, clearly those charges weren't a personal challenge. And I have to say that they have put themselves and the country in this very terrible situation by running for office when they were indicted for crimes against humanity.
And Makoa Matau, the fact that they are political rivals who now are working together, albeit under this cloud, does this go to the kind of political class that rules Kenya? With, you know, there's an enormous amount of corruption involved in politics. It's just inescapable truth, as far as I can tell. And
yes,
it just seems to be that there's a political class that we're talking about here.
Exactly correct. I mean, you know, so we need to remind our readers that our listeners that in 2007, in the last election cycle before this past one, Mr. Kenyatta and Mr. Ruto were on opposite sides. In fact, Mr. Kenyatta's Kikuyu ethnic group was involved in the attacks against or counterattacks against Mr. Ruto's Kalenjin group. The two groups, the Kikuyus and the Kalenjins, attacked each other viciously, and it's from those attacks that you know, Mr. Ruto and Mr. Kenyatta are now standing trial at The Hague. It's perplexing to everyone that these bitter rivals, you know, came together last year, or rather this year, demonized the International Criminal Court, claimed that the court was, in effect, targeting Africans, that it was a racist court, and mobilized, you know, their ethnic communities to vote for them based upon, you know, these obviously baseless allegations against the International Criminal Court. And so I would say that the elites of the two groups, the political classes of the two groups, have come together, in a kind of a pact to save the two indictees from this National Criminal Court. It bears reminding that no Kenyan court has ever convicted a senior-ranking member of the political class for corruption. Kenyan courts have, for the most part, been unable or unwilling to pursue, if you will, powerful people in a country, powerful, wealthy, people in a country for either, common crimes or for the theft of public resources, or even for human rights offenses. And so this is why the International Criminal Court was an important lever to bring justice to victims, who were violated in 2007, 2008. You will remember that over 1,000 people were killed, 650,000 displaced, property, pillaged. It was just a terrible time for Kenya. So in a sense, one can say that the attacks, of course, on the Mo are just horrifying, barbaric, and savage. But the actions of the president and deputy president in running for office and the indictment and now standing trial at The Hague do not make life easier for Kenya.
Well, clearly, corruption has had a corrosive effect on Kenya and on the fabric of its society, because you recall recently the fire at the airport, the main airport in Nairobi, which took forever to get put out. The firemen were accused of looting. They didn't show up for the longest time. And I think isn't that symptomatic of a system of where the political elite is a sort of kleptocracy and it's sort of set in a kind of moral rot?
It's really quite sad, and it is sad in particular when you think that Kenya is the largest economy in Eastern Central Africa. It is the anchor state of the region. It is really a hub. Nairobi is a hub. It's crossroads for international activities in the region. Kenya's middle class is highly sophisticated, well educated, but yet the political class, is one of the most corrupt in the world. The fact that the police forces are themselves, they're corruptible and corrupt. The fact that security forces participate routinely in human rights violations, and in protection rackets for corrupt politicians. The fact that, when the fire took place at the airport, the fire engines were not working, that the fires had to be put out many, many hours after the fact, by people using buckets of water. One of the major airports in Africa did not have, a working fire, a single fire truck, that fire engine that was working. So this is just emblematic of the corruption, symptomatic of the corruption that I think is pervasive within the state, and which the elite has, put in place, over the years. It's clear also to me that lack security at the mall was responsible, is partially to blame for these attacks. The Kenyan state has known for a long time that Al-Shabaab might retaliate for the attacks, for the participation of the Kenyan Defense Forces in the war against Al-Shabaab in Somalia. The Kenyan state has known this for a long time. Why in the world the Kenyan state would not have put together in place security measures to make sure that, targets that are likely to be picked by Al-Shabaab, like, for example, major international hotels, shopping malls, places like the airport, that those areas would be secure from attack, boggles the mind. Why that was not thought about. It appears that that many of the guards at the mall may not even have been armed when the attackers came, to do their dastardly deeds. So it's really sad. And I think, as you correctly pointed out yourself, the state is a corrupt state. And I think what we are seeing now is the result of some of that corruption.
Well, just in closing, Macau Matua, obviously the Al-Shabaab terrorists are trying to drive a wedge in Kenyan society between the majority Christians and the minority Muslims. Are they going to be successful?
Not a chance. Kenyan society, in spite of the problems that I've indicated, here, is highly secular. It's a liberal society. There's a press that is, quite free. There's a middle class that is very vibrant. Religion really has not been a wedge in Kenya's history. And I think the country, the country's population, whether it's Muslim, whether it's Christian, whether it's Hindu, because all of those religions are represented in the country's, population, is fully aware that that Al-Shabaab is a group that that needs to be vanquished, needs to be pursued and defeated, and that I don't think any Kenyan is going to be moved to feel animus towards Muslims simply because, the Al-Shabaab attackers are Muslim. I think that particular part of it will not succeed. In fact, on the contrary, what has happened from what I'm hearing, from my friends in Kenya, is that the attack has brought, Kenyans of all walks of life together, in spite of their religious differences, and so I don't think so at all. I think, in fact, the opposite, will be the case.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Macau Matua.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Macau Matua, who is the Dean of the University of Buffalo Law School and a State University of New York Distinguished Professor. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the former U.S. Ambassador to Syria. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ambassador Theodore Katouf, who's the President and CEO of AMIDEAST, which is the American Mideast Educational Training Service, a nonprofit organization that works to strengthen mutual understanding and cooperation between Americans and the people of the Middle East and North Africa. He's a former American diplomat whose 30 years career in public service spans several countries, including Kuwait, Baghdad, Yemen, United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Syria. In 1988, he was the director of the Office of Lebanon, Jordan, and Syrian Affairs at the State Department, and from 1992 he served as the Deputy Chief of Mission in Damascus, and from 2000 to 2003 he was the United States Ambassador to Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Theodore Katouf.
Thank you, Ian.
And what's your sense then of how this deal is proceeding, the Kerry Lavrov deal? President Assad recently told Fox News that the chemical disarmament would take would cost $1 billion a year and would take a year, and he suggested the U.S. should foot the bill. What do you think of that?
Well, he's actually right when he said it will take a year. I think a lot of experts say it could take even longer. And clearly, somebody's going to have to pay for it, not necessarily all of it the U.S., but there will have to be somebody underwriting the operation, obviously, the U.N., hopefully.
So the Iranian president, the new president, Hassan Rouhani, who's visiting the UN this week, and there's rumors that he may bump into President Obama on Wednesday at the UN. He said that he can help bring peace to Syria. And my understanding is that it was the Iranians who first seized on Secretary of State Kerry's offhand remark at the London press conference, where he said the only way that the Syrians could avoid being bombed by the US was to give up the chemical arsenal, that they behind the scenes told, basically they apparently have more influence on Assad than anybody. They told him to accept the deal and then allowed the Russians to take credit for it because they recognize that they're kind of kryptonite. They're not particularly popular. Is that your understanding of how things proceeded?
Well, Ian, I think you've described one very prominent report quite correctly. I think we'll be a long time getting at the whole story. I don't think that we know it. I'm skeptical that things happen so quickly that the Iranians could go to the Syrians and then go to the Russians right after an offhand remark by Kerry in London about, as you indicate, about maybe we could avoid a strike on Syria if they would agree to disarm within the next few days. I have to believe that there was something being discussed earlier than that. And I'm not saying that Kerry made that remark deliberately to trigger this. I don't think he did. But at the same time, I don't think there was enough time for all that to fall into place so quickly if something hadn't already been in the works.
But I think as a diplomat, Ambassador Theodore Khatouf, what do you know about Iran's new foreign minister, Zarif? Everybody seems to think that he's a pretty accomplished guy and definitely a refreshing change from the Ahmadinejad team.
Well, you know, again, Zarif is seen as a pragmatist and somebody who knows the nuclear file very well, and the fact that Rouhani appointed him would strongly suggest that they're interested in seeing if they can do something to lift sanctions, which are badly harming the Iranian economy, perhaps far worse than we've been led to believe up to now. And that could explain why we're seeing all these overtures at the moment, since you have to conclude that the military threat doesn't appear that real to the Iranians. I mean, Obama ran into a lot of difficulties in trying to get public and congressional support for a strike on Syria's chemical weapons, or at least punishing Syria and deterring it from the use of chemical weapons. So if you're sitting in Tehran, you must be saying, he doesn't have much support for military initiatives in the Middle East. So it must be the economic pressures that are getting to them.
And you don't think the fact that they lost over 100,000 to chemical weapons in the Iran-Iraq war and towards the end, it was the terror of Scud missiles with chemical weapons landing on Tehran and other cities that apparently drove Ayatollah Khomeini to, as he put it, to drink the poison and seek peace with Iraq?
Well, again, you raise a very good point. The Iranians, I happened to be in Baghdad during 3 years of that Iran-Iraq war. And Saddam was using chemical weapons against massed charges of young Iranians. And it was an effective terror weapon. And it did break several Iranian offensives. And interestingly enough, the Reagan administration tut-tutted quite a bit, but never really took any action against Saddam, at least not for chemical weapons. So it's a weapon that horrifies Iranians, and there's a revulsion in Iran against the use of those weapons. And I'm sure it's embarrassing for the regime to be seen backing the Assad regime that is using those weapons, even though the Iranians, like the Russians, try to claim that it's the opposition that's stage managing all of this and making Assad look bad.
And again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Theodore Khatouf, who's the president and CEO of AMIDEAST, American Mideast Education and Training Services, a nonprofit organization that works to strengthen mutual understanding and cooperation between Americans and the peoples of the Middle East and North Africa. He's a former American diplomat whose 30-year career in public service spans several countries, including Kuwait, Baghdad, Yemen, United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Syria. And in 1988, he was the director of the Office of Lebanon, Jordan, and Syrian Affairs at the State Department. And in 1992, he served as the deputy chief of mission in Damascus. And from 2002 to 2003, he was the United States ambassador to Syria. And Ambassador Khatouf, you're one of the few people that's actually met Maher Assad, the younger brother, who from all accounts is a very violence-prone, a very secretive person. He's in charge of the regime's Praetorian Guard, the Republican Guard, and also oversees the murderous militias. He shot his brother-in-law in the stomach during a family dinner argument over dinner. Is it possible that he was the one who ordered the chemical attack, given that nobody's said that it was actually the Assad regime? They hold them responsible, but nobody's actually said who ordered it. And, of course, the Russian apology for it and those that swallow the Russian line is that it doesn't make any sense that Assad would do this.
Well, I did meet Maher al-Assad many years ago once over a lunch hosted by a Gulf diplomat, and he looked nothing. He looked to me like a mafia wannabe, and I'm only being half facetious. He had the look of somebody who wanted to look tougher than he was, but clearly he is the fellow who sees himself as the protector of the family. The Assad family and the regime. He plays the same role to Bashar as the younger brother of the late Hafez al-Assad, former president of Syria, played for him in those years, which is enforcer and all-around tough guy. So it's very possible Maher had something to do with ordering the strike. It had to almost certainly come from somebody high up the chain of command, but again, what happens in Syria tends to stay in Syria in terms of knowing what's really going on. It's a very secretive regime, and we've never been particularly good at figuring these things out right away.
Well, the UN report, though, indicates the trajectory of these rockets filled with sarin came from the Republican Guard headquarters at the foot of Mount Qasun, which is Maher's headquarters, and on the other side of Mount Qasun, another Republican Guard facility.
Given that, I guess would there a lot of suspicion point to Maher? Of course, and presumably there is intelligence within the U.S. government that may even pinpoint some of the people who gave and carried out the orders.
But the ironic thing here, Ambassador Theodore Khatouf, is that this Kerry Lavrov deal may well save the Assads, at least for another day. There's a possibility that at some point or other the regime, the military and intelligence people may remove them. I mean, what's your sense? It's a pretty tightly run ship. It's basically a family farm for over 40 years. So, and their Muhabarat, their intelligence service, is supposedly one of the most efficient in the Middle East.
Yeah, you make a good point. I might say it saved two presidencies, because I think our president, his foreign policy credibility was on the line and he was backed into a corner. So ironically, the president of the United States is able to do a reset, and also Bashar al-Assad has new life. I think he was, perhaps I shouldn't put it quite that way, because I think he was in no danger for the moment of being ousted in any case. But if we do not want those weapons to fall into the hands of the most extreme radicals in the Syrian opposition, these jihadis who may not be a majority of the opposition, but they're certainly a very strong and powerful faction within the fighting forces, then we almost need Assad, don't we, stay around to help locate these weapons and ensure that outsiders have access to them to either remove or destroy them in place. So there's a certain you know, de facto need for Assad, or at least a regime insider, to be in power right now.
And do you think, though, that if something happens this week at the UN, and of course the new Iranian leader had an op-ed in the Washington Post where he called for an end to blood feuds, could it be possible that we could have a pivot to Iran? You know, there was the famous pivot to Asia. But in this case, wouldn't it be quite radical in the sense that, first of all, it would seem to me on the surface that the Iranians and the Americans and by extension the Russians have one thing in common. They don't want these Sunni jihadis running Syria, and they don't want Syria to be the Somalia on the Mediterranean. So would it be possible that we could more move towards the Iranian orbit, away from the Saudi-Israeli orbit?
I don't see things going that far, but I think that Iran has influence on a lot of things we care about. Afghanistan, which we're going to be leaving, certainly on the Gulf, our friends, Saudi Arabia and the smaller Gulf states are at dagger points at times with Iran, but they fear Iran as well. Iraq, they have a lot of influence, and of course Syria and Lebanon. And then there's the nuclear file. So, you know, it seems to me there's only three things that can happen. Either we engage with Iran, it turns out to be productive, and we're able to address a gamut of issues, not just the ones we want to address, which is the nuclear file, but ones they want to address as well in the region. Or two, we have, at some point, we're faced with either allowing Iran to have the capability, at least, of building a nuclear weapon on short notice, or three, we have to go to war to prevent it. Given those choices, I would think that the Obama administration is looking very, very closely and with a very interested eye at what might be possible from this opening that the election of Rouhani has given us, and the fact that he seems to some extent to have been empowered by the supreme leader Khamenei, although that's a short leash that can be, and he could be pulled back at any time.
Well, but my understanding is that he has a lot of credibility with the Quds and the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, which he comes out of. And it's a bit like the Nixon going to China syndrome, you know, where he could deliver. But I guess the real issue will be next Friday in Vienna at the IAEA meeting, where Iran for the 11th time is going to be asked to open up its nuclear facility. So I guess the proof will be in the pudding next Friday.
Gee, and I feel like I should be interviewing you because you're so well informed on you clearly are a great student of these issues and have an impressive amount of knowledge about them. The other thing we haven't touched on is the Kerry Lavrov agreement has not been solidified, and that is that the UN Security Council, the United States and Britain and France want to see a Security Council resolution about Syrian disarmament vis-a-vis chemical weapons with teeth in it, meaning under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter, which would allow for either severe sanctions or even military action if Syria was to renege on this deal or delay it interminably. And the Russians, as usual, are protecting Syria and the Assad regime and saying it's much too soon for all of that. There will be time later. But why are you so suspicious? The Syrians are going to comply, so let's not go there right now.
Right. Well, Ambassador Theodore Khatif, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Theodore Khatif, who is the President and CEO of AMIDEAST, which is American Mideast Educational and Training Services, a nonprofit organization that works to strengthen mutual understanding and cooperation between Americans and the people of the Middle East and North Africa. He's a former American diplomat whose 30-year career in public service spans several countries, including Kuwait, Iraq, Yemen, United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Syria. And in 1988, he was the director of the Office of Lebanon, Jordan, and Syrian Affairs at the State Department, and in 1992, he served as the Deputy Chief of Mission in Damascus, and from 2002 to 2003, he was the United States Ambassador to Syria. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with Sister Simone Campbell. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sister Simone Campbell, the Executive Director of NETWRC, a Catholic social justice lobby. She was singled out for criticism by the previous Pope for what the Vatican believed to be the promoting of radical feminist themes incompatible with the Catholic faith, specifically NETWRC's ties to the Leadership Conference of Women Religious and its support for President Obama's health care reform push, as well as its failure to promote church teaching on abortion, contraception, homosexuality, and the male-only priesthood. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sister Simone Campbell.
Glad to be with you, Ian.
And the Pope, in an interview with an Italian Jesuit journal, translated and reprinted in the Jesuit journal America here in the United States, has obviously shaken up. It hasn't changed the church doctrine, but it certainly changed the conversation, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. What a delight to read of the Pope's insight. And I think one of the things that struck me most deeply about the interview as it's published is you really get a view into his spirituality, that he knows that each individual is made in the dignity of God, as we say, and that that dignity then gets carried out in each person's journey. And he's so empathetic with each person's journey. I just found it really uplifting.
And when he said the church sometimes has locked herself up in small things and small-minded rules, ministers of the church must be ministers of mercy above all. Is that a call to get people out of their palaces, the cardinals and others, into the pastoral work of the church?
Well, I think that he's really challenging leadership to move away from this rule-driven righteousness, this certitude that small rules can provide into the complexity of modern life. And certainly his life is an example of a greater simplicity, of a sense of engagement of people that the Pope calls people on his cell phone. I love it, because what it says is that he knows he needs to be around people and that it's in community. I mean, he spoke really passionately about his need for community, his need to be part of the group, to be supported. And I think his way is to welcome all into that community and then to journey together. He's challenging others to do likewise.
And in terms of giving up the limousine, not staying in the Vatican, staying in a much, much more humble quarters, in general, he seems to be setting a real tone here. But most of all, when he talks about the church's obsession with gay marriage, abortion, and contraception, you, of course, were pulled over by the previous Pope over those very, you know, in fact, the Pope said in the interview, he said, you know, a lot of people have been pressuring me to talk about abortion, you know. And when he did, boy, did he surprise people.
Absolutely. But I think his point is that it's a question of balance. As you say, he didn't change any of the church's teaching, but what he said is this is not the only focus, that there is so much more life in the gospel than this obsession. And quite frankly, it is pretty ironic that the very thing that we got criticized for, he himself is doing. It makes me think. It just kind of makes me laugh, because eventually good news comes around, so... I'm thoroughly enjoying it at this point.
And again, I'm speaking with Sister Simone Campbell, the Executive Director of Network of Catholic Socialist Justice Lobby. She was singled out for criticism by the previous Pope for what the Vatican believed to be the promoting of radical feminist themes incompatible with the Catholic faith, specifically Network's ties to the Leadership Conference of Women Religious and its support for President Obama's healthcare reform push, as well as its failure to promote church teachings on abortion, contraception, homosexuality, and the male-only priesthood. Now, obviously, some of the cardinals, I think the previous Pope put a cardinal in charge of looking into your organization and into the Leadership Conference of Women Religious. How are the Cardinal Dolans and the conservatives who really openly supported the Republicans in 2012, and it's worth noting that you spoke at the Democratic Convention, have they been undercut by the Pope's words? I mean, after all, the Pope said, I'm not a right-winger. I've never been a right-winger.
Right. And that he's calling on all of the church leaders to be about balance and not about obsession. I think that there is a change that is happening. For instance, Bishop Tobin up in Providence, Rhode Island, had issued in his own diocesan newspaper a statement, I think it was 2 weeks ago, saying that he was very disappointed in Pope Francis because Pope Francis hadn't spoken on these things and it was very important that he speak on it.
Well, on abortion specifically,
yeah. I'm not going to. So right. I think that that is shaking up some of the leadership. The hard part for our leadership, though, is that they have not, for the most part, they have never really had pastoral experience. The John Paul II and Pope Benedict only appointed bishops who had a maximum of 5 years of pastoral work. And if you haven't walked with people who struggle, and that's what Pope Francis has done in his life, he walked with people who struggled. And when you do that, your heart's broken open, it changes your perspective. And so our bishops are sort of crippled by their lack of experience. And when we were doing our Nuns on the Bus trip, I kept inviting people to come and meet our people because it is meeting people who struggle that open your heart to the deeper message of the gospel.
So is it possible that the cardinals who chose this pope may have buyer's remorse?
That definitely is a possibility. But you know what? From my perspective, as a person of faith, the Holy Spirit is alive and well, and this is such a gift of fresh air, much needed in the church. The whole idea that Pope Francis doesn't want this smaller, purer, sanctimonious church, but rather wants all of us struggling. In fact, he called on everyone, all of us, to make a mess. Be prophetic, make a mess, be audacious. In one of the lines in the interview I just love, he says, "You cannot bring the frontier home. Rather, you have to live on the borders and be audacious." I thought, isn't that fabulous? It's fantastic.
So how does this translate into what we're seeing now? You've had this tectonic shift in the tone in the Catholic Church, and you've struggled to help implement President Obama's so-called Obamacare, and now it's been defunded or for the 42nd time by the Congress, and now they're really going to the mat over it. Is there any chance that the Pope's words are going to echo into the House chamber here and the Congressman Ryan and others who of the Catholic faith will be listening? Because this is an extraordinary irony that we have this, what you call this breath of fresh air coming out of the Vatican, and then we have this stale, poisonous acrimony coming out of the House of Representatives.
Exactly. And both John Boehner and Paul Ryan, I mean, they are practicing Catholics, and it matters to them. And I don't know what's going to happen. A lot of this is about the political game of trying to let House Republicans who are going to face re-election in 2014 look as far right as possible so they don't get challenged by Tea Party types in the primaries. I mean, that's what this is about. It's an election politics, I think. And the fact is that, I mean, even though they voted 42 times, I think it is, to defund Obamacare, that's not going anyplace. It's not happening. This Obamacare is a huge step forward for our nation. Business wants it. Labor wants it. Ordinary people want it. So it's going to happen. But the politics of it for the House is that they don't want to, they want to be able to show that they stood up and opposed it for other electioneering issues. So I think in the end, it's all going to, it's going to happen, but unfortunately, I don't think it's because the politicians are going to listen to the Pope at this point. I think they're just going to listen to the polls and to the reality that we cannot leave our nation in such disarray as they would want to do. So in the end, I think rationality will win out. I'm not sure faith will.
But surely you've got some very powerful financiers behind the Tea Party caucus who are pushing this, and they're in safe seats. And not only are they in safe seats, they've got the Koch brothers' money and the Club for Growth money behind them. And it would seem that one of the things I find extraordinary about the Democrats being somewhat on the ropes over this when they have a strong hand is, for example, Eric Cantor, the majority House Majority Leader, says, let's defund this law now and protect the American people from the economic calamity that we know Obamacare will create. I don't understand why the White House doesn't turn those words around and say, because we know what the real motive here on the part of the House Republicans and their backers, and Pelosi referred to their backers in the insurance companies, is that they are afraid that this thing's going to work and the American people are going to love it.
Absolutely.
And it's going to be really bad for them over the long haul. So I don't understand why the president doesn't turn their words around and say, okay, if you guys feel that this thing is going to be such a calamity, why don't you let it go ahead and go into law? And then if it crashes and burns, as you say it will, then you guys are going to be heroes, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think one of the things is that I know that the president's staff is trying to do is to not engage on their message, but rather to maintain the positive message. And it may come to what you're saying. I mean, it seems kind of obvious to me, too. But the fact is that they're working really hard not to have their agenda thrown off by this right-wing, what I consider slightly nutty activity, the politicking part of it, but rather stay focused on the substance. And I can admire that in a way. On the other hand, I just wish he'd put it out there the way you say. It could help.
Well, I get stuff all the time from very conservative groups from the Koch brothers' many fronts. The latest one is Generation Opportunity, which is a youth group that they've quite literally paid for that is encouraging college kids not to sign up for Obamacare. And if these activities work, you know, the whole thing is predicated upon the broadening up the pool. So everybody has to join Obamacare starting in October in order for the pool to be big and therefore the prices to go down. So you can't deny, I think, Sister Simone Campbell, that they're out to sabotage it. They're doing what they can to...
Right. Well, but part of it's optics. Part of it is just to look like they're sabotaging it. Because as I've gone around the country, I've spoken at a lot of colleges and universities, and I've sort of asked the question, most of the kids that are in colleges and university are on their parents' health insurance. So because they can now stay on their health insurance until they're 26 because of the Affordable Care Act. So there's not a large pool of college students who are uninsured. It is the ones between 26 it's the folks from lower economic strata, that's true, or it's the folks from 26 to about 35 that are the largest pool of uninsured. But as I understand it, the Koch brothers have been looking, and this program has been looking at college students, which is more optics than reality.
So you think this is more about shoring up their morale almost in terms of fighting the good fight for the very right-wing constituents of these very right-wing politicians?
Well, maybe it's because I'm a person of faith, so I always think good things are going to happen. I have hope. But, I don't see the substance in this one. If they were working at rallying the working poor, which they're not, then I think that's more of a concern, because those are the folks that are going to get the subsidies, the sliding scale, reimbursements, those kinds of things. So I think, and there's also the people that don't know about insurance, how to sign up. It's going to be we have a big task ahead of us to get the uninsured enrolled, but it's not college students that are the uninsured.
So, Sister Simone Cameron, just back to the Pope's words in the last couple of minutes here. The Pope Francis did reject the ordination of women to the priesthood, but however, he did indicate that he wants the Church to do a better job in hearing women's voices. Quoting the Pope, "Women are asking deep questions that must be addressed. The Church cannot be herself without the woman and her role." What do you take from that?
Hope still lives quite well within the Church on the issue of women. I mean, earlier he had said that we need a deep theology of women, and, well, I think we need some theology of men also if we're going to do that. But the irony is that there is a whole body of theological reflection done by women. I think he's just not aware of it. So I have some theologian friends who are in the process of getting their writings, their materials to the Vatican so that he can read it and see what we think. There's actually quite a bit of work that has been done. And I think his point is that he said change doesn't happen quickly also. He said change takes time and that he's slowly opening doors that will eventually join the 21st century. I hold out hope on this one.
But the broader point, I guess, that the Pope wants the Church to be less judgmental and more pastoral, that could, in fact, yes, be a revolution in a way. I mean, given that the last two popes...
That, and it's actually, in as many ways, returned to the roots that we are in relationship with people who struggle. And quite frankly, the way our teachings, the Hebrew and Christian scriptures, everything points to walking with those who struggle. Just yesterday I was doing a workshop and we were talking about the way forward is to touch the pain of people. Come to people with empty hands and receive their story. Hold them. And if you do that, if you receive people's stories, then what you have released hope because we're connected. It's about community. And that's the big change that I think is happening.
Well, just in closing, Sister Simone Campbell, for the more secular amongst our listeners, I was very impressed that the Pope's favorite movie is Federico Fellini's La Strada, which is one of the...
Wasn't that fabulous? That
one
was
of
great
my favorite
news.
Movies, yeah. Yeah. So you agree with him as a film critic then?
Well, I'm not exactly a film critic, but I think it's a fabulous film. But it sounds like he's seen a lot more films than I have. But his analysis I thought was great. So, and I was glad, it seemed like in the interview he brought it up himself, because he was talking culture beforehand and talking opera and, you know, symphonies. And then he said, well, we need to include the film. And I thought, oh, that's great. There's a 21st century idea.
And I'm speaking to you from Hollywood.
How fabulous.
Well, Sister Simone Campbell, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's an honor to be with you, Ian. Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Sister Simone Campbell, who is Executive Director of Network, a Catholic social justice lobby. She was singled out for criticism by the previous Pope for what the Vatican believed to be the promoting of radical feminist themes incompatible with the Catholic faith, specifically Network's ties to the Leadership Conference of Women Religious and its support for President Obama's healthcare reform push, as well as its failure to promote church teachings on abortion, contraception, homosexuality, and the male-only priesthood. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Michael Scherzer. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. I'm